Things are going to start happening to me now.
You've done all the reading. You're a scholar. You're a professor. You've done all the reading. You've done the intellectual heavy lifting.
Or less, eat shit and die.
You wouldn't know a fact if it begged you all night long.
Want to, like, give the wrong impression, because I am very high.
F***ing right up behind him with a hatchet. Smash, smash, smash.
Yeah. I don't care. I'm a libertarian. What I'm getting is,
did you vote for Joe Jorgensen or Trump?
Who?
Joe Jorgensen? That was the perfect answer. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody, to the Libertarian Podcast Review. This is your humble host. Anybody buying that? Tyler Yonke. I am your host, though. I promised you a Leo Frank series, Mary Fagan Murders, 1913 issue, and I started one. I did one episode, giving you an introduction. I think that's very important. Check that out. Let me see. That is episode 121. Okay, it says part one on there. However, then I went on Jose Galison's show, No Way Jose, and talked about it a little bit more there. I then went on Alan Mosley's show, the late night show. I want to say Up All Night, but that's not what it is. And we talked about it a little bit there as well. I think I'll have those as additional episodes. But then our friend Pete Quinones came on my show. We had a great conversation. And then from there, he's like, hey, why don't you come on and let's do these things? And I'm like, you know what? Pete knows a lot about this. He used to live in Atlanta. He's a very knowledgeable person, and he is probably the best person to cue me in and to have me just spit this stuff out. Because, by the way, I think I know a hell of a lot about this. So what's interesting for me is I dug deeper into it. There's some great books. We'll talk about those. I'm going to put up a Substack of all my research here. And what I found out was I had a few things wrong and more in depth. So Pete and I go deeper than I have done with the others. I have some facts I think that were maybe not quite right, not necessarily material, but more important. And then Pete puts his perspective on it. So this is first one with Pete Quinones. We're doing three of those with him. So it'll be a total at least four that I've done specifically here on my show. And it's going to come up. I'm going to play it here. I just thought I'd do an intro for you first. But before that, look, everyone, Fox and Sons. Go to foxandsons.com for great coffee. I'm going to list the kinds off here. Den Blend Light, Tanzania Peaberry, Electric Boogaloo, Brazil Honey Drip, Honey Prep, which, by the way, is my favorite, Den Blend Light. And then they have some this new one here, Ethiopian Natural. Okay, which I haven't tried yet. And a lot of people, they do this as Alan did, and he says the sniff hole. Okay, that's great. I drink their stuff. Here's actually a mug showing Fox and Sons coffee. Fantastic. I make it. Maybe I'll make a video about how to look. There's a button. There's Mark. Claire has it. Justin Campbell pushes this stuff. I think even Alan Mosley. Yes, Alan Mosley does as well. But you know what? I don't really get much other than he sends me coffee. So 15%. I know with mine's 15. The other ones are like 18. Some of the go. Let's see if we can put our name on the board. It's Review. R-E-V-I-E-W. Go to Fox and Sons. Just buy a bag. I'm going to start hawking some of this stuff off here as well. So we're going to start giving it out. Do some promo stuff. Maybe, I don't know what. I've got to think about something that benefits me. So go to foxandsons.com. Promo code Review, get 15% off orders of 25 or more. I bet if you start ordering coffee with this thing, he's going to start giving more off the benefit of the review for everyone here. Okay, so here we go. Leo Frank, born April 17, 1884, died August 17, 1915. Check out right now the very first episode with Pete Quinones, Tyler Yonke, but it's episode two. So there's some overlap, but let me just give you basics. The first episode, I give Pete the underline, kind of the situation that happened, kind of give the players. We talk about the South in 1913, a few other aspects of that, go right up until the trial. And then episode two, it's all about the trial. And then the final episode and the trial, the appeals, and a lot of the legal stuff in there. And then the third episode, we're going to break into it a little bit more. And I have a wonderful, wonderful conspiracy theory with all that in mind that comes out. There you go. So everybody, without further ado, Tyler Yonke, Pete Quinones Show, Leo Frank. Thanks, everybody.
I want to welcome everyone back to the Piquinones show. He just had me on his show, so Tyler Yonke, I asked him to come on, but I think this is going to be multiple episodes, and I'm really excited. How are you doing, Tyler?
Great, Pete. By the way, I trolled you into putting libertarian in your podcast title in a positive way, so I appreciate that.
No problem at all. It's fine.
I'm kidding.
I know that you're I know that you live in the real world. You still live in the real world. So
well, you keep reminding me of what the real world is. So I appreciate that. Keep it up.
Cool. We're going to talk about. We're going to probably do a few episodes on the Leo Frank trial if everybody's up for that. Let's start with this. Why do you think you're? What special power do you have that you can really talk about the Leo Frank trial and you think you can, that some other people can't?
Well, as you heard, my name's German. So no, that's not a reason. I'm an attorney. And by the way, that doesn't necessarily do anything, but if you went to law school correctly, what they try to teach you is to how to think like an attorney. And some of that is being skeptical and maybe not so cynical. And then just not taking everything at face value and what's underneath. So great question as to, well, what makes me is then I'm very skeptical on things. As an example, and people may hate me for this, but things come up and we just love to take whatever our party's service. Killdozer is a great example. This is, people love to talk about the guy at the Killdozer, I think is in Granby, Colorado, goes out and kills people with his big thing because he's against the state.
Did he kill anybody?
Well, no, he tried to.
Okay.
Yeah, good. Thank you. And this is important, right? Which is, but I think he was just mentally deranged. He said he was doing what God told him to. So having a spokesman for your cause, be careful with that. Kaepernick's another one where he has, you know, Castro on his shirt and he's talking about police state abuse. Well, that doesn't really work. So you don't have to overdo it. You can pick right people that help represent your causes. And then if you don't play into the propaganda side, it's helpful as well. So I think I'm good about trying to see problems areas and then using the right people for the right reasons. And this is a prime example, the Leo Frank issue case, where they took a despicable person, they tried to hold him up on a pedestal, and then to push an agenda.
Hmm. All right, so yeah, let's get into it. Give us a little bit of background on, what happened? Why did the police arrest Leo Frank?
Leo Frank is a Jewish man from New York, Brooklyn. He was 29 years old. He had moved down to Atlanta, down in the South. He was actually born in Texas. When he was 3 months old, they moved to New York. His grandfather was a Confederate slaveholder. So just keep that in mind. So he's down, he runs this pencil factory. It's called the National Pencil Factory, MPC. It might be something involved there. So you make the joke there. I can't quite tie it in, but it feels like it. And I'll just call MPC from now on with that. So he's the supervisor down there and a girl gets married. It's Confederate Day. It's like the Memorial Day for the South. It's a Saturday around noon. This girl, I don't want to get into too much detail, but why was he arrested is this girl's murdered and they found her in the factory and there's only a few suspects it can be. And he's one of them that the police think that he may be involved.
So he was at his factory on a Saturday, which tells me that he probably wasn't a practicing Jew.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he was the president of the B'nai B'rith, like the secret society, not secret, but it's a Jewish community down. And so he was the president at 29. Okay. He was a reform Jew. He okay. had a rabbi, Rabbi Marx.
He didn't believe in anything. So
exactly. Exactly. And by the way, that's a great thought because that's what I thought too. I'm like, he's working on a Saturday. He always works on a Saturday. That's a problem. But I not for him, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is, and as someone who lived in Atlanta for 17 years, it's always had a very large Jewish There's been a large Jewish population there for a long time. I remember living out in Conyers, which is outside of Atlanta to the east. One town over is Covington, and there's this long road called Salem Road. Anyone who's driven across I-20, maybe you've noticed it. Salem Road is that whole area. Miles upon miles. I mean, just thousands of acres that was owned by someone named Salem who was Jewish, and way back in the day. And like you said, Leo Frank had an uncle who was a slave owner in the South. So when people start looking at when they start having the opinion that, and this is what I've seen over and over again, and E. Michael Jones talked about this on the episode we did together, when people have the opinion that in 1913, the Klan or pretty much anyone else down there, there was this large anti-Semitic kind of geist where it was just who they were. Completely false. Completely false.
And by the way, there's so many strings you can pull on this. I believe, so there's three phases of the Ku Klux Klan. Okay, we don't necessarily need to get into all of it, but the more, you know, people think about the Ku Klux Klan now and their marches against the Jewish people. That was not the original. The first section of the Klan, which is what, early 1860s to ended about 1870, there were Jewish members. Yeah, there were Jewish members in the Klan. Even the second one, which they say starts in 1915, and some of it they try to tie in with the Leo Frank case, the Knights of Mary Fagan, which is very suspect if that's even the case. It's really the nation of the Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith, his movie that was a big deal from the book The Klansman. And actually, that kind of was a rebirth. But even then, that still involved a lot of Jews, or a decent amount. And I think that the pushback that the Jews gave to the South in this case for this despicable guy is actually what ended up making more of a pushback against them, which was a later filler, perhaps even into the Klan, probably the third wave.
Right. The first Klan was really a reaction to Reconstruction.
Exactly.
Nathan Bedford Forrest, who's picture on the wall. Yeah. Picture on the wall over there. I'm in Alabama.
It's, by the way, it's interesting when you read about the Klan how the first two disband. Almost, it sounds like the Libertarian Party, which is there's too much confusion. People are organization, they don't really know what they're doing. And next thing you know, Bedford, Forrest, he's like, "Hey, I'm out. I'm disbanding this thing," as an example. So,
All right, so that's out of the way. It wasn't this. They didn't look at him because they didn't look at Leo Frank because he was a Jew. They looked at Leo Frank because it was only him and really one other person who had opportunity.
We can walk through some of the timeline with this if you want to. Actually, you know, before, in case someone's totally confused about what happened here, this is 1913. It's a murder of this girl. This guy, Leo Frank, he's a Jew. He goes to murder. They said he murdered this girl. Out of this comes the ADL. And the ADL is kind of what spurred some of this. And there are a lot of ones that are still pushing the propaganda. What's important also about this is that the B'nai B'rith that he was a president of, that's where the ADL specifically came from. So the Birth of a Nation and the Birth of the ADL all kind of at the same time. All right.
I know I'm going to get this wrong. I might get this wrong, and I want to apologize, but I do want to say hello to somebody who, after I did the E. Michael Jones episode, I received a newsletter in my P.O. box, and it's the Mary Fagan newsletter, and it's put out by the grandniece of Mary Fagan.
Yeah. Kate Fagan, I think is her name or something like that. Yeah.
And I wanted to thank her for sending that. That was a very interesting It's nice that people are still doing newsletters.
she put out a book trying to kind of counter some of this. There's multiple books. Denison, this guy that wrote it in the 60s. Steve Olney was a big one. And then anyway, go ahead. I don't need to keep piping.
Well, no. Yeah. So, all right. So she's murdered. She's found in the factory itself. The factory is owned by Leo Frank, And there's also a black gentleman who, the stories go that he mopped the floors, everything, so he just stood by the front door. And it appears that when it comes to the investigation, there's only two possible people who could have done it. This black gentleman named Jim Connolly and the owner of the factory, Leo Frank. Is that correct?
Yeah. So to start out with, Mary goes to pick her paycheck up at the pencil factory. Now, I don't think he owned it. I think his uncle actually owned it. He was a superintendent. Doesn't matter. It's all family. So she goes to pick up her paycheck on Saturday. Saturday was a holiday. It was closed. They typically pick it up on Friday. And one of the things is her friend went to pick it up for her. And Leo's like, no, she's got to come here herself, which was not usual because friends picked up paychecks for each other all the time there. She comes there. She's off on this trolley with one of her friends. She gets off. And now the timelines gets important. She had cabbage for lunch, which actually comes out to be kind of the forensics that you have of this. She comes to the factory around noon, and she comes to get her money. She gets it from him. He signs off in the thing, and he is the last one to ever see her. Now, Jim Connolly, who you mentioned, yeah, he's kind of your derelict guy that works there at the, do you mind if I say the N-word in
here? I don't care.
He's considered, even by other ones, they call him a low-level nigger. So that's just, the way they describe him. Of course, we're talking about 1913 here. And he's at the place, but her body is not discovered until the night watchman, Newt Lee, another black man, finds her about 3 a.m, tries to call Leo Frank, not a good one, calls the police, and then they come over there. As it works out, much later down the line, Jim Connolly admits to knowing something about the murder. So essentially, yes, to answer your question, Jim Connolly and Leo Frank are the only two it could possibly be. Connolly points the finger at Frank. Frank now has to point the finger back at Connolly. But even to get there, Pete, Leo Frank tries to pin the murder on a white guy. He then tries to pin it on Newt Lee. He then tries to pin it on Connolly. So he's always pinning it on someone else. And the black guys are the ones that he really tries to emphasize.
Yeah, that would seem to make sense because of the tenor of the South at that point. And
yeah.
So, all right. What leads them? What evidence? You don't need to build the case before you arrest someone. You just need some kind of substantial evidence. To what is it that they find? What's the evidence that leads to Leo Frank being arrested?
So yeah, good. Yeah. Newt Lee, like I said, the night watchman, he finds her down in the basement. He doesn't even know if she's a white girl, or black girl. Her face is so messed up. And it's kind of dark down there. So he calls the police. They come over, they question him and, immediately, hey, black guy, young girl, she's 13, by the way, young girl, he's probably the one. So, but he's all straight up about everything that's going on. So they arrest him. Then they're immediately somewhat, I don't know if they're suspicious of Leo Frank, but they at least do some good police work where they don't just give it away. Like, you're the white guy. Of course you had nothing to do with it. They called him up. He answers and they're like, hey, we're going to have to come get you. This is in the morning. They go to pick him up and he is super nervous, like over the top. Right then, that's where they start to be suspicious. They ask him if he knows who this Mary Fagan girl is. And he's like, I don't know. I'll have to check my books. This is all important later on because he had multiple interactions with her. So, of course, you'd know who it is. I think the night watchman did tell the police that Leo had called him around 7 or 8 that night, which he had never done, asking if, is everything okay? So there was already a little bit of suspicion. They take him to the, not the coroner, but where she's being interned, or her body's there at the, I guess it'd be coroner's office. And Leo Frank went look at her. He's really super nervous. Then when they get him over to the factory and they're walking him through, he's acting really weird. So they're immediately on edge and he ends up, they take him into the police station after that evening or that morning and walking around, and they actually tried to have him interrogate Newt Lee to get some evidence out of him, which ends up just going not too good for either party. But they're both arrested. They end up arresting Jim Connolly as well, and he hangs out in jail for several weeks.
So from what I understand from reading other things, that Leo, when they brought him to the factory, he was so nervous and shaken that he couldn't hold things in his hand. He was a complete wreck. And obviously he was nervous that he was caught. But I guess the thing about the whole trial or the whole case is that, how quickly do we get to the point where his lawyers show up and make it all about, you know, the deflection away and how he's a pillar of the community, yada, 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 all this, all that?
So that, not really yet. Matter of fact, it doesn't get into the, till we're into the trial where they start to, that's, by the way, so I know I've heard you talk about it. The only thing they charged him with were murder. Okay, that was it. It wasn't rape, by the way. We can talk a little bit about that because that's actually somewhat questionable. But even then, the same way back in 1913 as it pretty much is today, you can't try to prosecute someone on their character. And, you know, like a prostitute, you don't get to say, oh, she's a prostitute, that's why she was raped. No. But if they bring up his good character, you can rebut it with bad character. And that's one of the mistakes that they started to do, was they wanted to show his good character and him being a pillar of the community during the trial. And then what it allowed everyone to do was to bring in all these instances where he wasn't. And some of the salacious stuff that he was doing in the building, bringing girls in, touching them, looking in the bathroom all the time, opening their door when they're dressing, all these kind of things. And then specifically the stuff that Jim Connolly was able to testify against or about.
Was there ever a, I just want to pick one thing out before I forget it, was there ever an attempt to pay Jim Connolly to admit guilt?
So Jim Connolly he's the guy that works there. His deal with Leo was, he would have him come in on certain days, and this was the day he said it was supposed to be the case. And by the way, he's in jail because why not lock up the black guy? He's kind of sitting there. After a few weeks, he finally is like, let me talk to someone. He wants to start telling him some stuff. The reason he wanted to start telling him things was because he changes his stories multiple times. Okay, so it's a little bit problematic. But when he does testify 16 straight hours, cross-examined by some of the best lawyers in the country, let alone the South, he holds steady, and it's pretty stellar. What he claims is that he is supposed to be watching out for Leo. Leo brings girls in there. They just want to talk. Leo says, tell you what, I tap my foot, you shut the door. When I whistle, you open it and we're done. And he's like, he had done that multiple times for him. Different girls would come in. He seemed to like the plump girls. I don't know if that was the reason, but Jim Connolly did mention that multiple times on the testimony.
Jim Connolly may have been projecting.
What's hilarious, Pete, imagine this. Leo is sitting there, you know, he's the defense. He's at this table. His wife is there the whole time. Jim's talking about all these other girls. And at one point he does an anecdote about Leo Frank talking about a watch, because Jim Connolly had bought a watch and he had borrowed money from Leo. So Leo actually takes money out of his pay. And he's like, I don't know why you want, this is what Leo says to Frank. And he's testifying to this. He goes, I don't know why you would want this watch. He goes, my wife, that fat lady, she wants a watch and I don't want to get her. So he's outwardly ripping on his wife as she's in court. I don't know. It's humorous to me. That's all I'm saying there. Yeah. Okay. Let's get back to it, which is he says that Leo gave him a wad of cash, $200, to burn the body. He says she hit her head. I put myself upon her. She didn't want, like, my what I was, you know, trying to come on to her. She resisted. I hit her. And then he goes, she hit her head, and then she's dead. So he wanted to have him help dispose of the body. He gives, and Pete, this might be the most, without trying to stereotype, he gives him $200 to dispose of the body. And then he goes, takes it back, and he says, I'll pay you when I'll pay you when it's done. So what does Connolly do? He's like, eh, whatever. And he went out to the bar. He didn't burn her body. And that might be that your refusal, your insistence on keeping the money, it might have been what actually caused him to get it ultimately get caught.
Wow. Wow. The stereo.
Right.
No one, you know, really no group can escape stereotypes. No. You mentioned that Mary Fagan and Cabbage. And I'm just like, well, the stereotypes are just flowing all through this one.
By the way, that and I think it's important at some point, you, it's your show, but you do as a, at some point, let's talk about the South a little bit more depth and how it actually was. She was Irish Catholic. The Cabbage is important because they were able to establish a timeline. Okay. She dies around 1230. She had eaten this stuff like 11:30, her mom said. So the digestion and how it's done, they can actually say, hey, this is the approximate time frame, which is very important because Leo said, I never left my office from 12 to 1. Didn't even go outside of the office itself. So, but her being Irish Catholic is also important because Tom Watson, who ended up being a big publisher, wrote stuff there, is an attorney. He came into light with this whole fiasco. He was very anti-Catholic. So for him to support her and support the black guy over Leo was something.
Yeah. Yeah. The, all right. So let's get back. Let's go back to this. So you have Jim Connolly there. You have Newt Lee. What eventually is it that causes the district attorney to say, this is the guy we're going to charge?
Yeah. Well, once again, he was evasive. He was very nervous. He didn't, you know, some of his actions were always putting the police a little bit on edge. He goes in immediately with the police. So what they had to do at the time, they had to, as a time card, the night watchman had to punch in every 30 minutes. Okay. Few things that kind of set them off to begin with. Newt Lee, the night watchman, he was told to come in early that day, 4 o'clock rather than 5, because Leo was going to go to a baseball game with his brother-in-law, Gentile brother-in-law, by the way. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but we just throw that out there. He shows up at 4 and he said Leo was acting really weird and basically shoot him out, said, no, you need to leave. Go hang out, go sleep somewhere, come back at 6. And he's like, well, can I just sleep downstairs? And he's like, no, you can't do that. So, but the rule was when the night watchman shows up, he can't leave the building. So one, he let him do that, comes back. And then you have some other instances, which is Leo's there. Girls start coming in to pick up their stuff. People saw Mary Fagan come in at 12 o'clock, never leave. There's not, you know, the building's closed for the most part. Another girl shows up at 12:05. She says she sits in Leo's office. He's not in there. She waits for 5 minutes. Montine Stover is her name, and then leaves. So you have a problem, which is during this time period, he says he's never left his office. Someone is there specifically that sees he's not in his office at all. So he's somewhere. And then a few other people here and there. There's a big guy that had just been fired that, without getting into too much, his name was Gant. Last name is Gant. He's a big, tall guy. He shows up to pick up some shoes that he had left at the building. And Leo comes out with this Newt Lee guy when he's trying to dismiss him. And this guy's like, I want my boots. Now, he had just fired him. There's rumor that Leo Frank had said to someone else, oh, he and Mary are pretty tight. This is well before. So there's a thought process, maybe a conspiracy theory that he had fired this guy to get to Mary himself. And anyway, this guy shows up, he's nervous and all. So those are the kind of the aspects that really started to bring the checking in of the time card. So when the police are there with him, he looks at Newt Lee's time card and he says, it's all good. He's checked in. Everyone looks at it just fine. A few days later, he then says, oh, I found his time card and he wasn't punched in 2 different times. That was plenty of time to go to his house and dispose of whatever he needed to do. So you might want to check on him. The police go to his house and in a barrel, they find a bloody shirt. Okay. So now this is like Tuesday afterwards. So as they start to investigate the shirt though, it looks like it was wadded up and wiped with blood or they wipe blood with it. So if you were to put it on, it doesn't match up anywhere. The armpits, as the coroner said, or the investigator said, they weren't stained. Immediately, that's where the police realized that Leo is trying to set up Newt Lee with a fake bloody shirt and a timestamp that had been altered because they had all seen it at the scene of the crime, the day of the or after the murder, that he had not missed any punches. So immediately the police are already suspecting that, which is an amazing thing to think of, that, you know, blacks were lynched pretty good in Atlanta for, you know, supposed crimes against girls. And you have a situation that's ripe for that, two black men. And Leo, though, is the one that they at least hone in on immediately.
I wanted to go back to something you had mentioned earlier. You had mentioned Connolly, him offering Connolly $200 to burn the body. When was that allegedly?
Like what day, the day of the murder?
The day of the murder?
So, yeah.
Okay.
So what happened there is Connolly is watching out. She comes in. He's watching like he's supposed to. He's sitting at the front on a bucket or something. He actually says he hears him knocking. And so he locks the door. He's making sure no one's coming in there because he wants to, you know, chat with her is what he says. Then he hears some footsteps down the hall. A little bit later, he hears a scream that gets muffled. And then he hears tiptoeing coming back. And a little bit later, he hears the whistle to come back up to him. That's when Leo says to him, look, I did this to this girl. I killed her. I didn't mean to. But you need to help me get rid of the body. So that's when they take her downstairs to the basement. Leo really doesn't want anything to do with it. And then he tells him, we're going to write these letters. This is a big deal too. There's like these notes that you're going to put out there. And he has Connolly write them. And Connolly doesn't, you know, it's Ebonics. He knows like five words, but he struggles to write them, puts them there. And it says basically the night watchman is the one who did this, as if the killers or as she is right. It's super confusing even to try to read them. And that's when he says, here's the money. And then he goes, whoa, I don't want you come back and burn her. And then anyway, so that, but you know, what's interesting to me is Connolly. I mean, this is a guy that was willing to take some money to burn a young girl. And then kept quiet. And then when he was in prison for a while, finally he's like, I don't think I'm going to get paid. So now I better come true with my story. This guy isn't the best. Now, he was a drunk. He loved to just go to the bars. He said he'd repay debts with beers. It sounds like a fun guy to hang out with. But he had also a lot of complaints about him peeing on the pencils. He took a dump down in the basement. When I'm first reading this, because one of the first things I read was the later on Governor Slayton makes a decision whether or not to commute him. And he has a whole report about it. And he does not like this Connolly guy. You know, it's a despicable person. You know, you're urinating on the walls and stuff. But I take that, you know, the urination, the defecating in the basement out, that seems bad. But when you read some of the transcripts, you realize that that's kind of what they expected the black guys to do. Like, they had white bathrooms. So he's like, I'm just doing this. Now, peeing on the pencils seems a little bit over the top.
I mean, it just seems a little savage, but that's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Something that you had mentioned, let's go over this. It is clearly, I mean, pretty much everyone who knows anything about this knows that she was murdered, but also that she was raped. And you said that that's questionable. Why is that questionable?
One, they didn't charge him for that. The coroner did an extensive, you know, analysis of her and her genitalia and her vagina at the time. There was no seminal fluid found. He said that there was appeared to be some internal, they called it violence, but then even on cross, he's kind of, you know, it looks like something happened that wasn't just normal, right? So something happened. Now, what's interesting is when Leo Frank tells, and this is just goes to fascinating stuff, when he's telling Connolly that he did this, he said, you know, and I struck her. And then he says, you know, I'm not built like most men. Now, I don't know what that means. Connolly seems to think, because they asked him in the trial, well, what does that mean to you? He's like, well, I've walked in on him before, and he's had his head between the legs of a woman, basically, you know. So I think his implication of that is like, he's not built like a normal man. Maybe he has erectile dysfunction problems. So maybe he was digitally penetrating her with his hand. That's kind of the idea. others seem to think that what he meant by that was he was just a frail, young, skinny guy, and that hitting a girl, you wouldn't expect her to hit her head and die. I don't know.
Okay. So when do they talk about Connolly finally getting released?
So they have him several times for a few weeks in the cells before the trial, where he's changing his story. Now, when it finally comes out and he's got the full story of what happened, the money changing or almost changing hands, getting told that there was, by Leo that he had murdered her, trying to burn the body, all that stuff. He had gone through about three different iterations of a declaration, an affidavit to the court, and he had changed his story. So obviously when you have someone continuously changing your story, when you come to court, that's going to be something that they're really going to hound on. And his point was, I buy it, which is, look, I was supposed to get this money. I didn't get the money. Now I'm worried he's going to come after me, but I'm still like, I don't want to bury him. He might give me the money. So he changes the story a little bit until the end where he's just like, no, this is, I'm done. I don't want to get pointed the finger at. So I'm going to completely give my full indication of the story. And then, there's accusations that have come out later on that he was coached by Dorsey, the prosecutor. And I don't think that's the case so much. I mean, like, what's just a few interesting things. 4-week trial. Okay. Longest that they had in at least Atlanta or Georgia, probably in the South, maybe in the U.S. at the time. So a long trial. Mr. Connolly testifies for two, three days, 16 hours of testimony. And up until this time, even being able as a black man, being able to testify in court was just verboten. It wasn't happening. Side note here, if you think about this, a black man testifies for 3 days against a white guy. Let's say this guy's a Christian. Okay. He's guilty. At what point is this not your Rosa Parks guy? It blows me away that he wasn't acknowledged as such, right?
I'm just thinking about all the people who are screaming at the screen right now going, Leo Frank's not white. Wasn't white. Okay.
but Pete, he was not considered anything but at the time.
And that's the thing. That's the thing about the South, too, is Jews were considered white in the South.
Yeah.
There were Jewish slave owners. There was Judah Benjamin, who was the treasurer of the Confederacy, was Jewish. Jewish slave owners, Jews. Sorry, but the Black Hebrew Israelites are right. They did run the slave trade, and they were considered to be Southerners. There's no doubt that's inarguable in 1913.
Absolutely, and I think they actually. I saw a video, and I think I played it on my first episode. I'd kind of done in this where a guy in the South, and he's like, he's a Jew, and he's like, oh, but I'm a Southerner. I mean, that's kind of like the mentality. Is just, you're a Southerner, and that might be more beneficial or strong as a communal tie, tribe-wise, than being a Jew at the time. I don't know.
So, all right. Newt Lee, how long is he held, and what does he contribute to end up contributing?
So Newt Lee, I think he was a stand-up guy, and I don't know how long he was held, but just like Connolly and a few others, they did figure out right away that he was just not someone that was part of this. Now, as you mentioned right away, and I've talked about when Connolly is basically given descriptions of the murder and what happened, and he's implicating himself by being part of this, I think you can rule out almost everybody else but Leo Frank and Connolly, right? I mean, why is Connolly going to say, this guy did it and I tried to help do that? You wouldn't even do that at all. So I think what he's saying is either full on true or he's the murderer. There's only two ways around it. And they felt pretty soon that Newt Lee wasn't part of this. Now, Leo Frank on that first day is allowed to go and try to interrogate Newt Lee outside of the police. He goes in there. They said, hey, you're his boss. Maybe you can get him to say something. And the only thing, they don't really hear it because it's a little bit private. The only thing they hear at the end is Leo Frank saying, look, if you don't come through with this, we're both going to hang. Now, I don't know what that means. Is that an implication of I'm guilty or something? But pretty soon after that, even when they found the shirt, they just didn't believe that Newt Lee was a part of this. So he was immediately exonerated immediately for then, you know, fairly soon.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about that. You're talking about a time in the South where the war is still, people are still talking about the war. I mean, there are people alive who fought in the war. There are people alive who lost their families to the war, lost their land to the war, lost their homes to the war. Yet, in this Atlanta community, they're willing to look past the two black guys and pin it on someone who was considered white at the time and a Southerner.
And I think, by the way, I think when the North really gets involved, and what I mean by that is the newspapers, you had New York Times, William Randolph Hearst started sending people down there. The three big newspapers, I think it was three in Atlanta, were first against Leo Frank, and then they kind of come out for him. There's a lot of interest and pressure that's just being built around this. And I think I don't know. I had a point there, Pete, and I forgot it.
I was talking about how they basically, at a time when they definitely shouldn't, when you wouldn't have expected them to overlook the two black guys, they went right to someone who was actually considered one of them.
Right. Okay. I got it. Appreciate that. That the mentality of what you might think of the South as a Northerner at that time, and I believe they thought it was super country. You're not very sophisticated. And it's going to be an easy task to exonerate this guy. And then you have the black men down there. And even Leo coming from the North, he was a mechanical engineer. I think he went to Cornell. So, you know, he was a fairly smart guy, thought a lot of himself. And I think the status is really what helped the prosecution, that the status on the other side and the believing that they are just so much better. And that's not necessarily Jew or not. It could just be that the white status, you know, how dare you have a black man even testify against me? So I think that made a big difference.
Now, I want to leave anything about the trial for the next episode. When do the newspapers start getting? Because when you start looking into actually the number, I don't even know if we need to go into it until the trial starts, but when you start looking at the amount of money that was thrown at this trial to make Leo, to prove that Leo Frank was innocent, I think I've read that it was $28 million in like 2023 dollars.
Yeah. So I had read 25. It depends on when you convert that, obviously,
right?
You know, inflation going where the numbers, but Let's even say 25, 28 million doesn't really matter. You know, I would love to have that kind of money for. Now, it wasn't all defense. That goes through all the appeals that he has. And by the way, this also goes towards much more than that, which is the investigators that they ended up getting, because that ends up playing a huge part. The NPC ends up hiring two big investigation companies, both out of town. They come out there to find the murderer and to exonerate Leo Frank. Doesn't help so much. So there was a lot of money rolling around. Now, you know, you mentioned just, we said $200 that he was going to pay him. This guy, Frank Connolly, was paid around $6 a week.
Jim Connolly.
So, what did I say?
Jim Connolly. You said Frank.
Oh, there's a lot of names.
Yeah.
Thank you, by the way. Jim Connolly gets paid around $6 a week. You throw $200 at this guy, that's a lot of money. So a lot of this $25,000 was later on trying to have people change their testimony, try to have other people make false testimony, that they were just throwing money every which way. Yeah.
Well, from what I understand, they may have even brought the Pinkertons in.
And yes.
It was Leo Frank's people who brought the Pinkertons in to investigate. And basically, they were hired to prove his innocence.
Yeah. And I want to say the Burks was another one or something like this. And there's this guy, Burns. I think he was a famous investigator. He was a bit trash and he had problems. But the Pinkertons and this other investigator firm, they testified in court for the prosecution.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing that this guy was so guilty that they couldn't do anything with it. So what else up until Well, like I said, we'll leave the trial for next time. But what are we missing? What do you think is relevant up until the trial that we haven't gone over?
I think it's somewhat important to understand the state of 1913 in Georgia. Reconstruction hadn't been all that long ago. You had a lot of this trial was full of like teenage girls testifying that they're working in this factory, so they're getting paid a pittance. Now, the ADL side likes to draw these things out as problems why Leo Frank was hated, right? Oh, he was hated. He was a Jewish owner of a factory. These girls weren't making much. Da, da, da. I don't think that would, because that tone did not take place during the trial and even in the newspapers until after the fact. Now it's fun to go back and try to do it with today's hindsight. But I think it meant something. I mean, there was crime going on in Atlanta. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about this. I know there was a boll weevil issue out in the West. And so the cotton was flying out there in Georgia, but it was the downtown Atlanta and that area itself. I don't know that they were necessarily doing so great. So it's an interesting time to think about all the different dynamics and in the South specifically and in that area.
Right. And you would think that because the economy was still trash because of everything that happened, war, you would think somebody who was successful as he was and is working for a company that's obviously making money, obviously, isn't paying their employees a lot of money. But I mean, from what I understand, those wages weren't much different than most factory work at the time, that they weren't hated. They weren't, the National Pencil Company wasn't looked at as this, they weren't looked at as like carpetbaggers, which I mean, really,
right.
Which is really what they could be considered. They weren't looked at that way. They weren't looked down upon. They were they brought jobs to the community. And, I think that's one of the reasons why they were so diligent in looking into this. And, I don't think they wanted to blame when you read it, they didn't want to blame Leo Frank. They would have much rather blamed it on Conley or even Newt Lee, but the evidence was just remarkable.
Yeah, and your carpetbagger comment is really interesting, because I think they come down and they're part of the community. You know, they're involved in there. I mean, he went out and did stuff with Connolly that day. They walked to some store together. You know, they're hanging out, whereas the carpetbagger is maybe down there. You know, I'm not a big I don't know a ton about it, but it's the reconstruction, those guys basically fleecing a lot more communities. Mary Fagan, she was there to pick, 13-year-old girl, $1.25 is all she was getting paid that day. I don't know. It's an interesting time to look back on, what your kids are doing or the amount of money that was being pushed around or what a dollar was meant for at the time. That's kind of that time period. Woodrow Wilson was just elected president too. So mm-hmm. we had that going for us.
Now you're depressing me. And let's talk about it. I mean, 13-year-old girls, we think about that now and we're like, it's insane to think about. But when you look at like her life, I mean, she woke up and she went on the trolley by herself. She stopped and would meet friends at a place to eat by right. herself. I mean, these girls were, because of what the situation was, and we've seen it in other countries, especially like a lot of the Asian countries coming out of the war, things like that. Yes, you would have to have what would be considered now child labor, but also, I mean, it seems like they, it forced them to grow up a lot sooner and be a lot more mature.
Right. And one thing I was reading, which isn't necessarily how you want to grow up, is they're talking about putting your daughter into one of these factories to work is basically to prostitute her out. And they don't mean like, oh, she's working for little money. And they mean she's going to get sexually assaulted. So what I couldn't quite get from the coroner's report when he was talking, it almost sounds like he said her hymen was already broke. And so there's a good idea. Maybe she wasn't even a virgin. So I don't know if she had been hooking up with Frank. It doesn't sound like it because Leo, because she rebuffed him at this moment. but he was definitely doing this with some others. So, but yeah, he was also with older women. So it's interesting. Do you call him a pedophile? I don't, perhaps, probably in our standard of time. I don't know what it was back then, if that was completely off limits. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if they had an age of consent at that point anyway. So, yeah, I don't think that comes until later. Well, up until, I guess, are we run up to the trial here? Can we cut this one and schedule another episode? Or
yeah, we can. No, I don't know if it's what's interesting about some of these things is I don't know if you want to talk about the news, the Northern. We can cut it. That's fine.
Okay. Yeah. Let's save the news, because that's really when you start getting into the trial too. When the influence. They're trying to influence everyone from public opinion to the lawyers, to the judge, to the, then we'll probably do a whole episode on the governor.
I'm ready to go with him, by the way, too. Yeah.
All right. Tell everybody, plug whatever you want, and we'll come back.
Just go to my Twitter. Yeah. I just go to Twitter. It's just, yeah, Tyler Yonke on Twitter. LPR, if you go to Rumble, that's another good way to do it. So check out our stuff. But just keep going, Pete.
I appreciate it, man. We'll schedule the next one. Talk to you later.
Thanks, man.
Okay, maybe
now. But she's back.
And now.
Chick-fil-A is completely overrated. It's not that good. I prefer Zaxby's. I prefer Popeye's.
Takes a tough man to make a tender forecast, Nick. I guess that's me. Keep fucking that chicken.
Should I vote for Dick Cheney on the Libertarian Party? Do I have an obligation to vote for Dick Cheney?
I would say so.
Yes.
Did it work for those people?
No, it never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but it might work for us.
That one dude was like, not a podcast. I can't find it anywhere. And they don't have video.
Oh, yeah. Peter Janke. Yeah.
Yeah, I blocked him.
I'll do it. If he unblocks me, I'll...
He'll buy your shirt if you unblock him, Bert.
He's a wigger.
Yeah, nothing cooler than a 49-year-old wigger. Like, yeah,
I just started live streaming. Cut me some slack. I'm pretty high-tech for a boomer. But anyways...
Boomer.